The U.S. may have the worst of the coronavirus pandemic, at least for the moment. But pandemic means worldwide. Every nation is being forced to deal with COVID-19 as best it can. In the developed world, sheltering at home has given rise to online shopping in places including Northern Ireland.
There's a realization as well that jobs are at stake, and that in order to try and ensure that as few jobs are lost as possible, that the economically online shopping represents a good option for many people.
But what about the ethics of shopping online? It's convenient for those at home, but potentially risky business for workers all along the supply chain. A bit later, we'll talk with Laura Steele at the University of Belfast about how to make choices. But first, the consistent inconsistency of President Donald Trump. Drastic pronouncements at White House briefings or late-night tweets are pulled back the next day. Bold claims about the powers of his office are modified after bipartisan backlash. Today, we'll look at a couple of recent examples with far-reaching consequences, immigration restrictions, and the authority of the White House over the governors of the 50 American states. Our guests are Asha Rangappa, who's a former FBI agent, now a lecturer at Yale Law School and contributor to CNN, and Stephen Vladek, who teaches the Constitution and federal jurisdiction at the University of Texas Law School. Welcome to you both.
Great to be with you, Warren.
Thank you.
Let me read what the president said on Monday night. In light of the attack from the invisible enemy, as well as the need to protect the jobs of our great American citizens, I will be signing an executive order to temporarily suspend immigration into the United States. That was a late night tweet. It has since been modified. Tell us what's happened.
Well, I think that what you see with Trump is a lot of yelling squirrel, right? I mean, this is sort of him bringing back his greatest hits in a time when I think he is probably feeling out of control in terms of how this is all unfolding. In terms of whether he can do that, the Immigration and Nationality Act delegates broad authority to him to suspend immigration. This is the issue that came to the Supreme Court in Hawaii versus Trump. I think he could do that if he wanted to, if he finds that it's in the interest of the United States, and in this case, to promote employment. Seems kind of tenuous, but I think that he might have that latitude. But I think that this kind of creates a bigger question of what I think of as sort of the delegation dilemma, which is that the president has all of these broad authorities that he can deploy in times of emergency, with the idea that he's going to deploy them, judiciously and with good judgment. And I think that what we're seeing in this case, as we've seen in many previous cases, is that he doesn't necessarily do that. He does it to promote his own interests. And I think that's where we have a big problem with his authority in these kinds of circumstances.
He started out in his tweet saying that he would ban immigration altogether. Now he says it's only about people who have green cards or who are applying for green cards. What's the difference?
Well, I think that he is now narrowing it down to people who are kind of seeking to remain permanently in the United States. So, for example, that might not include people who are coming on J-1 visas who would be students. And of course, if he were to categorically ban all immigration, that would include students coming here, which would have a devastating impact on universities, as Steve and I both know as we're watching this unfold and we're at universities, or temporary worker visas where people can come and work. So it looks like what he is trying to target now are people who would actually come and remain here, become citizens, and which is even stranger because those would be the people who I think would likely contribute most and bring their skills and expertise, especially in areas that we most need it now. I mean, my father immigrated here in 1970 when there was a high need for doctors, for example. So we often rely on this kind of immigration, people who want to come here permanently to get precisely the skills and expertise that we might need at a particular time.
Okay, we'll get back to this in a moment. But first, let me go to Stephen Vladek and ask you about this. The Attorney General of the United States, Bill Barr, has said that the Justice Department will take the side of people who sue state governors over alleged violations of civil rights caused by their crackdowns on, or if crackdown is the wrong word, their advice and counsel that we all socially separate. What's the situation there, and how does that represent a back and forth on the part of the Trump administration?
Well, I mean, I think there's a big difference, Warren, between, you know, what the Attorney General has said publicly and I think what we've actually seen in practice. So it's one thing for the United States government to show up in an existing lawsuit and say, hey, we actually, you know, share the views of the plaintiffs that this particular state shelter-in-place order or this particular local ordinance is unconstitutional insofar as it restricts, say, access to religious services, right? Things of that nature. I think what's really concerning about the Attorney General's statement, Warren, though, is that he's suggesting beyond that, there might be cases where the federal government itself is the plaintiff that takes these states to court. And, you know, that's problematic, I think, in at least two respects. One, it's a very different message than the one that the president has repeatedly sent over the past week, that he's leaving this up to the governors. It's hardly leaving up to the governors if the governors are taking these actions, you know, under the threat of litigation. But Warren, too, it's also not something for which there's a lot of precedent. There really isn't, you know, much in the way of historical examples of the federal government suing states to enforce sort of broad federal policy interests, as opposed to suing states because states were violating particular federal statutes. And so I think once again, we're seeing the federal government trying to have its cake and eat it too, by on the one hand saying, you know, we're not going to take responsibility for this, but on the other hand saying, but we're going to tell you local and state governments what we think you can and cannot do.
We heard a moment ago that the president may be resorting to his greatest hits at a time of difficulty when he wants to divert attention. In what way does this, do you think, represent that kind of political strategy?
I think so much of this, Warren, is politics and so very little of it is law. I mean, I think what's really going on here is you have a president who, on the one hand, really wants to not be on the hook for any of the consequences of either the belated federal response to coronavirus or of this, you know, newfound pressure to reopen businesses and schools in some states. But on the other hand, you know, he really wants to support this movement toward getting everyone, you know, back in stores, back in school, back on the job. And so I think, you know, what we're seeing is a series of very mixed messages because the president at once doesn't want to be responsible for reopening the country, but wants the country to reopen. And so splitting that difference, I think, is proving increasingly fraught, at least as a legal matter. You know, whether it's fraught politically depends on whether I think any of the president's supporters actually see the very sharp, I think, distinction between these two sort of simultaneous approaches.
So, Asha Rangappa, back to you. The president initially said he wanted to ban immigration. One of his own cabinet members, Mr. Azar, has said we ought to waive the restrictions on immigrants in order to be able to encourage medical practitioners to come into the country. So where do we stand now with regard to this issue on the pandemic?
Well, I think that it's becoming clear that we're going to need the expertise of medical professionals. And as I mentioned before, this is something that we have used our immigration policy for. As I mentioned previously, during the Vietnam War, we had a shortage of doctors. Our doctors were out, you know, helping the military. And so we used our immigration policy. A huge wave of particularly doctors from India and Asia came over then. You know, we should be thinking of immigration as a way to get, as a strategic way to get the kind of expertise that we want. Now, that doesn't fly well with Trump's base. So as Steve said, what's, you know, political and what's legal, you know, are two different things. And we know that the president has Stephen Miller as one of his advisors who has really tried to find ways to limit immigration in any way possible. And you know, even in ways that would harm the U.S., for example, with translators who've helped the military who might have paths to citizenship. Those have, you know, been blocked off in instances. So, you know, what we need right now may not be what is constituted in what the president is putting out there, which I think is just a distraction for his base.
The point has also been made that many of the immigrants involved are, in fact, working on farms, working in feedlots, working in packing houses, working in processing plants at a time when we really need them to bring food to the table. And there are issues for the opening up of states like Florida and Georgia that depend a lot on tourism as well. So how long is this ban on green cards going to take place?
I cannot speculate on what the president will do.
I think they said 60 days, at least the order hasn't been drafted as yet.
But, exactly. So I think we should also point out that the president often proclaims things by tweet that don't actually become policy. And so, you know, what he throws out could be a lack of impulse control and some way of, you know, alleviating his discomfort in the moment, which may not actually translate into policy. But, you know, once again, I don't know that limiting green card, you know, recipients really addresses the kind of, you know, the issue that I don't even know what it relates to in terms of what's in the national interest, but we'll have to see how it unfolds.
Stephen Vladeck, how confusing is it for governors, for law enforcement, for others, when the president issues certain guidelines with regard to the coronavirus pandemic and then encourages people who protest against the implementation of those same guidelines?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the oxymoron war and at the heart of so much of the Trump administration's response, which is, you know, the president wants to look like he's saying and doing the right thing, but he can't help himself but sort of reach out and support the folks who really are trying to undermine the very policies that the, you know, rational part of his brain is standing up in front of the country and saying we should all abide. And so I think, you know, that's a big part of why we're seeing such a sharp distinction across the country in how different jurisdictions are reacting, because there are going to be those jurisdictions, like here in Texas where I live, where the governor is going to be very inclined to sort of, you know, take the hints from the president because he thinks that's what his own supporters are going to want. I think that's what's happening in Georgia and South Carolina and Florida. And there are going to be states like New York and California and Michigan and, you know, large other chunks of the country where, you know, the governors and mayors are looking at the federal government and saying, you guys are not telling us what, you're not telling us what we need. You're not giving us what we need. We're just not going to listen to you. And, you know, it's obvious, I think, why both of those approaches are going to be attractive to the constituencies in each of those jurisdictions. Warren, my broader concern is that's not a very coherent, unified national response, the likes of which we really need to get past this, you know, this current crisis.
It's been said on this program and elsewhere that we have now what amounts to a kind of tribal situation where, regardless of what the rationales might be or what the logic might be or the inconsistency or whether it's an oxymoron, to use your term, people who are supportive of Trump and who are Republicans are simply going to support him anyway. Do you find that to be the case in Texas?
I do. And I think it's worth stressing, Warren, that, you know, I mean, Texas is, at least as of the 2018 Senate race, you know, a 54-46 state. And so, you know, we have a Republican governor, we have a Republican lieutenant governor, we have a Republican attorney general, who I think are trying very, very hard to basically appeal to the same base that President Trump has, you know, so much support from. But, you know, Warren, there's 46% of the people in the state who don't support those politics. And so I think what we're seeing is not just increasingly sharp contrasts from state to state when it comes to how our politics are influencing our views of governmental responses to this crisis, but increasingly sharp contrasts even within states, from city to city, from neighborhood to neighborhood. And I think Texas is actually increasingly on the front lines of that.
Warren, can I jump in on that particular topic? Just because I teach a little bit on this when, you know, I look at disinformation and its impact on democracy, which is that, you know, often the adoption of a belief or kind of a set of policies, in this case, you know, support of whatever Trump is saying, is not based on actually a belief in the underlying facts, but rather it's a signal of loyalty and membership. And so I think that that's especially important to understand when we're dealing with something that is, you know, scientific, as this virus is. It's based on, you know, science and facts. But, you know, Trump is sort of giving the signal on what which way he wants to go. And his supporters will move in that direction, not necessarily because they think that that's safer or it's, you know, that they don't believe the virus exists, but because that is a way of signifying their membership in kind of the Trump tribe. And that's the danger for us as we kind of move forward, is that we're no longer basing policies on facts, but kind of this this signifying of tribal membership, which can create a problem when the leadership isn't really moving in a coherent and productive direction.
And does that include situations where people may, in fact, be advocating against their own best interests? So for example, in red agricultural states that really need to have those foreign workers come in, or in tourist states where they need foreign workers as well in order to handle the basis of their economy?
Yes. Cognitive behavioral scientists call this directional motivated reasoning, which is it's kind of they will rationalize it based on kind of it being consistent with their tribal, you know, identity or partisan identity. So it can actually be against their own interest, in fact, but they don't want to risk kind of being thrown out of the tribe, if you will. And so that safety of the membership means more than what the practical impact is on them. So I think you do see a lot of people acting against their interests, as we see with these protests across the country. I mean, we see people protesting, they're not socially distancing, they're yelling and, you know, spreading their germs everywhere with, you know, no masks on. But yet this is the way that they demonstrate their solidarity and support for Trump.
So the conclusion has to be then, it seems to me, that at a time when what we need most is national unity, we have politics that lead in exactly the opposite direction. That's conclusionary on my part. But Asha Rangupta, do you see it that way?
Yes, I do, for sure. I think that this is, and I think this is what is so frustrating for many of us, is that this could be one issue that is not partisan, that could be based on experts and science and facts, and not, you know, I get frustrated because it seems like this is one thing where it would be so easy to show leadership and unity. And unfortunately, I think we don't have the person in the White House who can do that in a unifying way.
Stephen Vladek, any final comment?
I mean, I think it's just, you know, I go back to sort of the where we all started, which is, you know, for the better part of the first 80 years of this country, the United States was thought of as a plural noun. The United States are the United States, you know, collectively. And it's a sort of post-Civil War phenomenon that we think of this country as a singular noun, that, you know, the United States is, that we're all in it together. And, you know, Warren, I think the real concern I have in looking at not just the difference in responses from state to state, but also in the extent to which the federal government is actively, I think, playing into those differences, is that I think in some ways we're backsliding toward the United States as a plural noun. And that's really not something that worked out well for us the first time. And I think it's not something that's going to be, you know, in the best interest of the country going forward.
And just let me point out that in my generation, we were raised to say the United States as a nation of immigrants. We may not have meant it in every way possible, but we used to say it all the time. And obviously that is the case. But again, the situation that we are getting from the White House may be reflecting on something very different from that. Stephen Vladek at the Texas School of Law, Asha Rangupta at Yale, former FBI agent. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Now let's find out how much we have in common with a place we don't hear about very much, that's 5,000 miles away, Northern Ireland, where sheltering from the coronavirus pandemic has people trying to decide, when is it okay to shop online? Back in a moment with To The Point.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. The coronavirus pandemic has you sheltering at home. Brick-and-mortar shops, department stores, and the mall on the corner are all shut down. But you really want that blouse or those shoes or that table for out in the garden, and you can buy it online and have it brought to your front door. Is it really okay to do that? That's the question asked in an article by Laura Steele. She is an associate professor in business and society at the University of Belfast, and she joins us from inside her home in Northern Ireland. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Warren. I'm absolutely delighted to be talking to you today.
Delighted to talk to you. So you're sheltered inside just like we are.
We are. And despite the fact that we're 5,000 miles apart, there's probably never been a time where our common interests and our common concerns have been the same. We're also sheltering in place, or we're really referring to it as being under lockdown in the UK. And we're all having to adjust to the changes that have come about very, very rapidly.
It's interesting you should say it that way, because I think particularly with the current president, there's less of a sense in this country of a common feeling amongst our nations than there has been before.
Yes, we're in an interesting position in Northern Ireland, actually, because we're part of the United Kingdom alongside England, Scotland and Wales, but we share a border with Ireland. And so we're seeing both countries in terms of their response to the coronavirus crisis. The UK was slightly slower in terms of responding to the crisis, arguably, than Ireland was. And as a result, the most recent figures suggest that the death rates in the UK are sitting at around 13.4% compared to 3.8% in Ireland. And part of that is as a result of the population density in Ireland being lower than that of the UK. But equally, Ireland put into practice social distancing measures a lot earlier. And so as a result, the death toll, thankfully, has been lower there. So being in Northern Ireland, we're seeing two countries in terms of how their response to the coronavirus is rolling out.
No doubt the economy is staggering as it is here. Have there been protests about the sheltering rules?
Those haven't happened yet, Warren, although we can start to see, certainly from news reports, some early evidence of people feeling as if that perhaps the lockdown has gone on too long or has been an overreach by the government. But we certainly haven't seen the level of protests that I believe that you're seeing in the United States. Last week, the lockdown, and it's a term that I'm using, but certainly there are still freedoms that we have. We can go out and get our essential groceries. We can exercise. Those who have to go to work can go to work outside of the home. But other than that, we're being recommended to stay at home as much as we possibly can. But the lockdown in effect was extended for another 3 weeks in the UK, taking us into early to mid-May. And then at that point, the government has advised that they're going to reconsider the position. But the reality is that normal is probably still a very long way off for us at this stage. And it could be several months, if not longer, before things revert to how they were back in January and early February.
Well, what about this issue that you wrote about, that there you are in your house and you can get unnecessary goods, if I can put it that way, if you want them. But the question is, should you? How do you see that? What are the issues involved?
Well, it was an issue that came around because a number of people were asking me for my views on it as a result of someone who deals with business ethics for a living. And I think it's a question for which there's no easy answers. And we can certainly see the arguments on both sides. So as you'd highlighted, that there's really significant economic concerns. We haven't really started to grasp the full impact of that in the UK and Ireland, but it's certainly going to be highly detrimental and likely long term. So as a result, the government in the UK and in Ireland are still encouraging online purchases as a way to maintain some sort of economic normality to help keep people in work and ensure that businesses, as far as possible, survive. And the other side of it is that many of us are stuck at home and we're looking for something to positively puncture our day-to-day lives. As you said in your introduction, that blouse or perhaps some home decor, garden accessories and so forth that bring a little joy back into life. But the other side of the argument is particularly around the health and safety of people involved in the supply chain. So the individuals that we tend to identify first are the delivery drivers. But to an extent, that has been addressed through contactless delivery. So they can leave things on people's doorsteps. They can take care when loading their vans and so forth. The greater challenge tends to be around warehouse staff. That in some warehouses, it's very, very difficult to socially distance, and those individuals may not have access to appropriate and protective garments that they can wear in during the course of their day. And so certainly in the UK, and I believe to some extent in the United States, that a number of individuals working in warehouses and the unions that represent them have come out and expressed their concerns regarding the safety of those workers. In the UK, a number of high-profile businesses actually shut down their online operations because they felt they couldn't guarantee the safety of their staff. So Next, for example, which is a very large UK retailer, shut for a significant period while they looked at how they could realign their warehouse systems in order to support the health and safety of their workers. They only reopened within the last number of days. They actually were so overwhelmed with people trying to make purchases online that they had to briefly suspend taking orders on their website and then open them up again the next day. So there's really strong arguments for and against. And so as a result, it's hard to be prescriptive in terms of what people can do. What I personally am doing is trying to order from companies that have made efforts, as far as I can tell, to try and ensure the health and safety of their workforce. But the reality is it's not always possible to get access to that information.
So there's so many players involved, and you're absolutely right about the warehouses in the United States. Amazon is the one that does the most business, and some of the Amazon employees have indicated their unhappiness with the situation that they are faced with. Amazon, of course, a multi-billion dollar company, one of the biggest in the world, and one that you would hope for some responsibility from. But as a consumer, you say the demand is really huge. Tell us what the balance is. If you're trying to decide to get one thing or another, how do you research it? What do you look at in order to determine whether, okay, this would be fine, I can order this thing, but maybe I don't want to order that one?
It's very difficult, and some companies in reality are more transparent than others. So certainly if you have local businesses that you're familiar with that are continuing to operate online and you feel that you can trust them in terms of how they're treating their employees, they might be the best port of call at this time. But as you say, really searching for the particular items that you're looking for and then looking at how those companies are dealing with the issue can be really challenging. You highlighted Amazon, which just like the US is a very, very big player within the UK. And there have been significant concerns about the experiences of some of their workers in warehouses in different parts of the UK and Ireland. And the reality is we can't always get a high degree of insight into what is happening. The best that we can do is perhaps do a quick search in terms of reputable media sources and what they are reporting about the treatment and welfare of workers in those organisations. But it's a murky area, and it's one where we're having to make decisions without full access to information, and that's the reality of the situation.
If the companies aren't sufficiently transparent, what about the unions? And do you trust the information that you hear from the unions, or are they in any way exaggerating their concerns?
So the main players in terms of the unions in the UK, for example, GMB, are regularly distributing information or releasing information about what is happening. I would say from my own reading of it, it tends to be quite measured. I would say they're not overstating what is happening. And certainly we've seen images inside some of the factories, or sorry, inside some of the warehouses, where it is clear that it's going to be incredibly difficult for people to maintain a sufficient distance from each other, or that they're not wearing sufficient protective equipment. So I'd say certainly in regard to what I've been reading, what I've been seeing in the UK, that the unions have been taking a measured approach. I think that there's a realization as well that jobs are at stake, and that in order to try and ensure that as few jobs are lost as possible, that economically online shopping represents a good option for many people.
Well, let's go back to the essentials. You get food in the same way. People bring it to your house, and obviously they have to go through similar kinds of issues. And of course, the whole food chain is subject to different problems along the way, whether it's drivers or packers or pickers of crops or whoever it might be. But are the ethical issues sort of beside the point when you're talking about food?
Absolutely. So in the article, we had drawn a distinction between essential and non-essential items. And part of the reason for that is, as you've highlighted, that food is absolutely essential. It is necessary in comparison to the blouse that you'd mentioned previously, which is maybe more of a want to have rather than a need to have in most situations, although by no means all. So we're experiencing many of the same issues that I believe you are in regard to the food supply chain. So the end of the supply chain, we have the supermarkets. And so we're still having a lot of people going to the supermarkets to purchase their groceries. There's been a huge strain on the online delivery services within the UK and Ireland. So while we do have home deliveries and click and collect deliveries where people can go to the supermarket and collect their groceries pre-bagged for them, still a large number of people are going to the supermarkets in order to carry out their shopping. And that is obviously putting some of those workers at risk. So some supermarkets have, for example, installed clear plastic screens and so forth in a bid to protect the workers. There is also, and I don't know whether this has been the same for you, Warren, but there's also been reports of, unfortunately, workers within supermarkets being subject to abuse in terms of customers who are unhappy with the changes that have been introduced. So now, for example, we generally have to queue outside, and it's a one-in, one-out system within many supermarkets at the moment. And also restrictions have been placed on purchasing certain goods. So, for example, in regard to tinned goods or pasta and so forth, in some supermarkets, we can only purchase 3 items at a time. There's been pushback against that from customers or from some customers, and as a result, staff have faced hostility and harassment within, unfortunately, their workplaces. But then, as you discussed previously in another episode of your podcast, it really extends all the way down the supply chain. And so there's concerns in the UK at the moment in terms of harvesting of fresh produce. So recently, there were several plane loads of workers brought in from other parts of Europe to help pick fresh fruit and vegetables to ensure that they don't end up rotting in the fields. But again, it raises concerns about the health and safety of those workers, many of whom have to live in quite close quarters whenever they're here engaging in fruit and vegetable picking. So there's certainly ethical concerns, there's health and safety concerns right throughout the supply chain that are having to be considered.
We talked at the outset, you did, about how although we are 5,000 miles apart, we have very common concerns. It's really interesting to hear what you have to say, because it sounds like a mirror of what is happening in California and in other parts of the United States. And whether you're in Los Angeles or whether you're in Belfast, capitalism, however it's practiced, and it is practiced in different ways, is still an innovative system. Are there prospects for innovation, do you think, under these circumstances?
Yes, absolutely. So we're seeing the early shoots in terms of innovation happening, where businesses are having to rapidly respond to the situation. So perhaps one of the most heartening demonstrations of that, and I believe, again, that you've seen that yourselves in the United States, is businesses who are now producing ventilators or personal protective equipment at very short notice in order to meet the really quite serious demand issues that have arisen in recent weeks. But we're also seeing businesses engage in acts of social responsibility. So one of the greatest examples of that is probably happening within London, where a number of businesses have come, food-related businesses have come together in order to ensure a supply of food to vulnerable members of society, but also healthcare workers who are struggling to get access to fresh food and hot meals during the course of their day. I'd certainly imagine that over the next number of months that we're going to see businesses really forced to innovate as a result of what's happening. And certainly, as the saying goes, necessity is the mother of invention. And so we may see some businesses being able to rapidly respond to the challenges that lie ahead. But as you say, there's also going to be a significant number of businesses that unfortunately don't survive this crisis. And there is likely to be a significant number of people who end up unemployed as a result of that. And it's whether they can be redeployed in other areas and how fast that transition can happen is going to be the really big question.
You are a teacher at the University of Belfast. And I wonder, you have students who, of course, have never seen anything comparable to this, not that any of us has, but some of us at least are old enough to know that life can be full of shocking and difficult circumstances. But this one is pretty basic and seems to go deep into the future, or might well do so. How are the kids responding?
They're responding really well. They've shown themselves to be incredibly resilient. I'd say the most difficult part for many of our students was the early weeks of the crisis, where there was enormous amount of uncertainty. So the cohort of students that I'm teaching at the moment are very international. So I have students from China, India, Pakistan, Malta, and various other countries. And so they found it particularly difficult because they were very cut off from their friends and family back at home. And I would say undoubtedly it was taking a toll on their mental health. And for some of them, they're still experiencing quite significant anxiety around the issues. So many of those students chose to return home. Our university made the decision, I think around 4 weeks ago, to shut the campus, and we rapidly moved everything online. And again, sort of harking back to the innovation within business, we've had to innovate too in terms of how we are doing things, and we're probably moving at a rate of knots. In reality, we're probably doing things 2 or 3 years ahead of what we might have done otherwise. So we are wanting to ensure that our students get the best possible experience in the circumstances. But the reality is that I would say on a weekly basis, I am being contacted by students who are really concerned about what is happening, and they're attempting to continue their studies, while at the same time, many of them are dealing with sick relatives, bereavements within their families, really huge concerns about the economic impact of this. And I think that's going to be felt for quite a long time to come. So, for example, there was a study released today in the UK that stated that around 80% or just over 80% of young people with a history of mental ill health have stated that their condition has worsened since the crisis started. And so I think everyone, regardless of the situation they find themselves in, really needs to think about protecting their own mental health and helping support the mental health of those around them. We are lucky to be in an institution that is, you know, is very supportive of the mental and physical health of both the staff and the students, but we're going to need to be mindful of the burden that those students are facing going forward. And it's raising questions as well about student numbers and what that's going to look like for us in September, because we have quite an international student body, as many universities in the United States have as well. And many of those individuals who'd been hoping to come to us and for the next academic year simply may not be able to travel, unfortunately.
All right. Well, once again, we've been talking with Laura Steele, who's an associate professor of business and society at the University of Belfast. She's speaking to us from her home in Northern Ireland, 5,000 miles away. What is most important, it seems to me, for the purposes of this conversation, is how much we have in common and how similar the problems are that we are dealing with when it comes to COVID-19. So thank you so very much for telling us what's happening in Belfast.
Thank you, Warren. It's really been an honor and a pleasure to speak with you.
We're all at home, but this podcast is produced from KCRW in Santa Monica. Our producer is Andrea Brody. Our engineer is Chuck Prevetary. Other episodes are available on your favorite podcasting app, and we're at To The Point _KCRW. You can tweet me at Warren Olney won. Now, as everybody shelters in place, at least everybody who can, people are spending more time than ever with KCRW. And this community on social media is very important to the whole Los Angeles area. It's a vital service. And we're not immune to the financial disruption caused by this crisis. So we need your help in order to keep going. And if you can't afford to give, please do it now and do it for those who can't give. You can donate directly by going to kcrw.com/give. Thanks in advance.